This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
The people who we need to be most focused on coming out of this pandemic, not just while we're in it, but after it, as we learn the lessons from how we got here, are the people who are working harder than ever, many in two jobs, three jobs, trying to make ends meet. But because this economy is only working for the wealthy few and those wealthy corporations that benefited from Trump's incredibly foolish, lopsided tax cuts in 2017, we have an economy that is only working for them.
Coronavirus disease 2019, also known as COVID-19, is spreading and threatening the lives of the physically vulnerable, including the elderly and people with a variety of pre-existing conditions. In response, businesses, cities, and states are shutting down. The entire San Francisco Bay Area, the economic engine for much of California and the rest of the country, has been ordered to shelter in place, and other areas are considering similar measures. That means countless restaurants, retail outlets, and small businesses are closed. This approach should stop the spread of the disease, but what other impacts will it have? Specifically, what will it do to the economically vulnerable? Today on Sea Change Radio, we're talking about poverty with Rebecca Vallis, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. We discuss the potential repercussions of pandemic policy on wage workers, distinguish between a booming stock market and authentic economic health, and talk about the plight of people truly living on the margins, like prisoners and the homeless. Finally, we examine the faint possibility of a silver lining in the way some politicians are proposing economic relief in response to this global crisis. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Rebecca Vallis. She is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. Rebecca, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks so much for having me back. It's a pleasure to talk with you.
Yes, we all have a little more free time than we're used to, and I appreciate you stepping away from your apocalyptic preparations to speak to me and our listeners about the work that you're doing.
Yeah, these are certainly bizarre times. I have to say, my guy and I actually decided to watch World War Z the other night, and we weren't sure if that was going to be a good idea or a bad idea, but it certainly gave me a lot to think about in terms of ideas for how to be prepared.
Well, I've started a new program with my 12-year-old since I'm not really very active in her homeschooling this week. That's Daddy Film Academy, or DFA, and we started off with Ferris Bueller's Day Off. Then yesterday was Slumdog Millionaire. And then we're moving on, I think, to Titanic next. But we're staying away from all overt pandemic-related movies for now.
It's probably the responsible parenting choice. I didn't have little ones to think about in this. I think, if I've scarred my cats, then that's on me.
So with the world melting down, why don't you give us a perspective from those who you fight for on a day-to-day basis, the most vulnerable, the people who are not able to necessarily just go into their homes and boot up Netflix and sit back and talk about all the terrible things that are happening, people who are actually worried about getting fed and staying warm.
Yeah, no, and you and I we're sort of joking because it feels like in a moment like this where there is so much anxiety, so much uncertainty, obviously, laughter can be the best medicine at times, but I want to be clear, obviously what we're facing is incredibly serious, and for just millions and millions of people in this country, this is not just going to be about staying indoors and, as you said, Netflix and some making cookies or whatever it is that people are doing in their apartments while they go a little stir crazy, that's sort of dominating the way that you're hearing coverage on NPR or on a lot of the mainstream news networks. The reality for millions of people in this country is that they're living paycheck to paycheck right now. Whether they're being sent home without pay, whether they're actually losing their jobs, a lot of folks in the service industry, particularly now that we're seeing widespread closures of restaurants and bars, and then just overwhelmingly this just incredible slowdown that is looming over this economy is having an incredibly real and immediate impact on millions and millions of families across this country who don't have a cushion to fall back on in a moment like this. And so in a lot of ways, I a lot of folks have been making this point, but it's hard for me to watch what's going on around us without really feeling like this pandemic is laying bare just how incredibly broken our social contract in America has been for a long time, and just how deep the inequality and poverty in this country has become. And all of that is on full display with the pandemic really, truly, in many ways, threatening not just to further deepen poverty, further exacerbate inequality, but to really pick and choose based on how much you have and whether you're one of the haves or the have-nots at this time. And I'm happy to kind of get into all the policy pieces of that, Alex, but that to me is really the big glaring takeaway from the moment that we're living through right now.
Yes, I like to look at things through this lens, in that Americans love to hoist people up on pedestals, and we love our heroes, whether it be servicemen or leaders of their sports team or their political party. But I think we're realizing that what you just said is right, in that the social contract has been broken for so many years, and perhaps some big event like this pandemic can lay that all to bear, where we realize that these previously labeled low-skilled workers, people who work as checkers at your local grocery store or lower-paid healthcare workers, they are just as important as anyone else, if not more, in terms of our social construct and our society functioning smoothly. We need those people, and we all too often forget about them.
Well, and a big part of what really needs to be mentioned in this moment, I feel like there's been a lot of attention given to the fact that people are going to be going without paychecks. As I mentioned, many folks, you know, especially lower income folks, low wage workers, by and large, don't have a cushion to fall back on in a way that can replace those missed paychecks for sure. But there's another element of this as well, which really directly connects the economics of a pandemic like this to the public health side. And that is the fact that huge numbers of people in this country, and particularly lower paid, low wage workers, just don't have paid sick days or any kind of paid leave. And so what that puts them in the position of having to do if they haven't been sent home from work, and we were watching this, you know, in the days and weeks before bars and restaurants started to close in cities en masse, including in D.C. where I'm located, is people making choices, impossible choices, between whether to go to work sick or to effectively quit their job, because that is what happens to many low-wage workers and hourly workers functionally if they don't have paid sick days and they get sick and they can't come in. And so that was, public health experts were telling us, a big part of what was really kind of standing in the way, and has been standing in the way, of social distancing, the practice that the Centers for Disease Control, the CDC, has been really trying to bang into our heads, is the only way that we can flatten that so-called curve, get this spread under control to a point where we're not going to overwhelm our hospital system and see the worst potential consequences of this outbreak. So paid sick days finally having kind of a front page moment in this country, and paid family and medical leave with people on both sides of the aisle agreeing, and even tacitly the Trump administration in this moment agreeing, that must be part of the response, and therefore that must be part of the policy conversation moving forward. And that would be my hope as someone who works on these issues for what happens when we start to see the country come up for air on the other side of this crisis, and start to re-examine how we got here and why we were so incredibly vulnerable and what it had to do with that broken social contract.
And let's turn to the policy and the policymakers. I didn't expect a day where I would see Mitt Romney being to the left of Nancy Pelosi, but that seems to be where we are in terms of sick days and trying to get the American worker through this crisis. We have Nancy Pelosi. Her philosophy apparently is that businesses should be shouldering the brunt of these sick days, while Romney's now part of the Yang gang and thinks that we should be paying $1,000 a month check to all Americans, like a UBI, a universal basic income kind of idea.
Yeah, it's wild times right now for a lot of reasons, I think it is fair to say, and politically as well. You know, I don't know that I'm going to go as far as to say that Mitt Romney is to the left of Nancy Pelosi, but I will say on anything, including on this, but I will say that what we need to be doing in this moment, and what I think you're starting to really see a strong push by economists, really on both sides of the aisle, as well as by public health experts, economic policy advocates, grassroots organizations, as well as now really a coalition, a strong coalition of lawmakers pushing for moving past false choices where we would be thinking about should we be doing, say, unemployment insurance, or should we be doing direct payments? Should we be doing paid sick days, or should we be doing, you know, help to businesses? I think the answer at this point is there is no way that we are going to do too much to try to kickstart this economy and put money and protections in the pockets and in the lives of American families and workers right now. And that is the loud clarion call, I think, that we're hearing from particularly economists and policy experts who really lived through and were the architects of the response to the Great Recession stimulus package, the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, that helped to get us out of that in incredible economic challenge. And so the lesson from that being, we need something incredibly big. We're hearing from folks on the Hill, from also folks in the White House, that there are ongoing negotiations to move through. Now we've had one kind of down payment package from the Trump administration. It was just a small kind of drop in the bucket that happened right away, about $8 billion. But we've got a second package and a third package on the way with a lot that's going to happen in the next several hours and days. So rather than kind of giving your listeners, here's where things stand in this particular hour as we're talking, I'll say that the policies under consideration, and I am really hopeful that we're going to see robust packages that include all of these things rather than, and many other things that I'm not mentioning, rather than kind of falling into the politics over which of these things should we be choosing. Paid sick days and paid leave are top of that list. There's been a lot of kind of political back and forth with agreed upon provisions that bipartisan lawmakers in the House had hashed out that weren't perfect, but that were strong, that advocates felt good about. Now there's talk that the White House is starting to undermine some of that. So we'll see where some of that goes in the coming hours and days. But in really important focus on strengthening unemployment insurance, which currently leaves behind all too many workers. And this is not a time to be missing workers who need the wage replacement that program offers when they lose a job through no fault of their own, which is textbook what we are living in incredibly broad numbers right now. Strengthen the package that's moving forward today and tomorrow looks likely to strengthen Medicaid as well as nutrition assistance. Importantly, and I should note this, your listeners may be aware, and I actually think one of the last times that you and I talked for this show, we were actually talking about nutrition assistance. That has, of course, been a program, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, formerly known as food stamps, that Trump has been just slashing 6 ways from Sunday. Some of those cuts were actually set to take effect in just a couple of weeks. And the Trump administration, it came out in the middle of all of this chaos. They considered whether to suspend those cuts, and they decided to move forward with them anyway, to take food stamps away from 700,000 workers in the middle of a pandemic. Thankfully, a federal court stepped in and said, no, this is a really bad idea in the middle of a pandemic. And by the way, these cuts are pretty cruel anyway, and might be illegal. So an injunction is now in place on that. But as you mentioned, this additional really important and robust discussion about the need for direct emergency payments to all families. And you're hearing a number, $1,000 thrown out, that hopefully is a good start, hopefully isn't the end of what we're talking about in terms of direct financial assistance if this crisis does continue to last for many, many more weeks, given that $1,000 is, you know, just going to be a drop in the bucket to a lot of families. But incredible to see this type of serious, robust policy conversation in this moment in a way that hopefully will have really important long-term benefits for the bipartisan potential of enacting these types of policies so that we have them there all the time, not just in the middle of a pandemic.
Well, once I lived the life of a millionaire, spending my money, I didn't care. Taking my friends out for a mighty good time, buying bootleg liquor, champagne and wine. Then I began to fall so low. Couldn't find me no friends, had no place to go. And if I ever get my hands on a dollar again, I'm gonna hold on to it till the eagle grin. I said, nobody knows you.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Rebecca Vallis. She is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. So, Rebecca, we're talking about ways that policymakers can help workers, but I'm hoping that something like this pandemic can open our eyes to the fact that all Americans are people, regardless of their work status. And then let's focus for a minute, if we can, on those who are either not working, homeless, or making ends meet as they can in the gig economy, which is a larger swath of the American public than ever before. How can we protect those people in very troubling times like this?
Yeah, I really appreciate you kind of framing the question in those terms. I want to quote Ayanna Pressley, a freshman member of Congress from Massachusetts, who in lifting up the need to also be thinking about people who are behind bars in prisons and jails in the middle of a pandemic like this, people who just don't have the luxury of engaging in social distancing or of hand washing, or who in the case of it came out in New York State that policymakers had decided, lawmakers had decided to address the hand sanitizer shortage by having prison labor fill the gap. And yet those same prisoners, it came out, were not allowed to have hand sanitizer or use it. Just incredible inequalities showing up. And Ayanna Pressley lifted up the need to remember those people. She said, and this is where I want to quote her, there is no hierarchy of humanity. And those words ring in my ears as I watch the response. Frankly, you know, until the past couple of, you know, maybe days, the lack of empathy shown by so many people who decided not to really care about their responsibility to engage in social distancing, despite what they were being told by public health officials pleading with them, please stay home, please stay home. And yet people going out to bars and restaurants and, you know, parties and whatnot, just because they didn't feel like they personally were at risk, and yet doing their part to continue the spread of this pandemic by choosing selfishly not to stay home. And a lot of the folks I work with in the disability community, people who live with chronic illnesses, serious health conditions, you know, have really been engaging in powerful social media activism to try to educate people about, you know, why we need to be thinking about people other than just ourselves in a moment like this. And you know, another group that you mentioned in your question who really needs to be thought about and not left behind in a moment like this for sure is people who don't have safe and stable housing, or people who are precariously housed as well. And those are two sort of overlapping groups. And this is something I and others have been calling for loudly. We need a national moratorium on evictions and foreclosures. This is not the time for people to be losing their housing because they can't afford their rent or they can't afford their mortgage payment because they don't have any income coming in because we're in the middle of a national pandemic. And yes, that's going to take a thoughtful policy response that will involve making landlords whole as well, given the farther reaching economic ripple effects of all of this, and the fact that we need to be thinking both about tenants and homeowners and the landlords, many of whom are low income themselves and moderate income. But these are the types of policies that are going to have a direct impact in determining what the aftermath of this pandemic looks like. Are we picking ourselves up off of after a crisis that has pushed millions of people out of their homes? Are we picking ourselves back up after our economy has seen such damage that we're not going to recover for years? Or are we going to be taking the swift, bold, and really significant action? Some economists are saying it might take $1 trillion and that we need to not be afraid to deficit spend so that we can be responding appropriately and commensurately in this crisis moment in ways that we will thank ourselves for down the road if we can be bold enough to do it.
Well, I can't help but think that one side of the aisle is looking at this through a trickle-down lens, even though I mentioned how we have this weird little policy discrepancy between Pelosi and Romney. I think the Republican Party and the Trump administration in particular is looking at this way too much, I think we'll agree, through the equation of the stock market equals the economy, which we know is not true in so many ways. But it seems like a lot of the hand-wringing in the White House right now is because the president was taking victory laps a few months ago because the stock market was up and now it's down and now he's freaking out. That seems to be much more at the forefront of his thinking and his lackeys' thinking in terms of how to boost up the stock market more than anything. How did we get to this place where this is the bellwether for our success as a people?
Alex, I think you're asking the million-dollar question, and I think you're also in the process really hitting the nail on the head here. Trump has spent the last, you know, almost 3 years screaming from the rooftops that he has created the quote-unquote best economy ever, right? That is the only talking point that we hear out of this White House, no matter what the issue is that Trump is supposed to be fielding questions about. He's on the tarmac. There's some, you know, something going on that's some kind of crisis of national security. And nope, he's, you know, he's talking to you about the stock market. And that is what he has been clinging to as the case he has been planning to make in November to the American people, but most importantly to his voters, those people that he has hoped would stick with him despite the fact that he has spent the last 3 years attacking programs and policies that help the very working class voters, many of whom showed up in 2016 for him in hope that he would save and bring back their jobs. You know, here we are with this message that we've been hearing from the White House and from Fox News, I should note, for quite some time about this quote unquote best economy ever based on just those two measures. And yet now what we're seeing is as everything is laid bare, as the bubble is burst, what's left behind? We've got half of this country, half of families in this country living paycheck to paycheck, struggling to afford basics like food, like housing, like health care. We are still struggling with millions of Americans not having health insurance, not having paid sick days, so that when a pandemic like this shows up, we are even less prepared and even more vulnerable than pretty much any other peer developed nations, no matter what we do, because that strong economy was a mirage. And the reality is, and the report card is in, American families are struggling, and inequality is on full display. And the people who we need to be most focused on coming out of this pandemic, not just while we're in it, but after it, as we learn the lessons from how we got here, are the people who are working harder than ever, many in two jobs, three jobs, trying to make ends meet. But because this economy is only working for the wealthy few and those wealthy corporations that benefited from Trump's incredibly foolish, lopsided tax cuts in 2017, we have an economy that is only working for them. And that is something that we are going to have to reckon with if we want to be able to move forward from this crisis.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Rebecca Vallis. She is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. Rebecca, you mentioned the plight of prisoners during all of this, and I give you a moment to explain some of the other work you're doing right now on their behalf.
Yes. So, and I appreciate you're bringing that up, and you're bringing it up in the coronavirus context too. So one of the other areas of my work and something that's actually really a special passion project for me right now is actually all about helping people who are returning from incarceration or who have come into contact with the justice system move on with their lives and have a fair shot at a second chance. About one in three Americans now have some type of criminal record. That's the legacy of our nation's failed experiment with mass incarceration and over-criminalization. One in three Americans have a criminal record. And having any type of criminal record can be a barrier, a lifetime barrier to employment, to housing, to education, and more. And so this new initiative that I'm really excited to be helping to launch is actually all around automating the criminal record clearing process so that people can get their records cleared, expunged, sealed, and move on with their lives, whether or not they're able to afford a lawyer and navigate a complicated petition-based system that leaves far too many people behind and without relief. It's called the Clean Slate Initiative. It's helping people in states across the country pass laws that will automate criminal record clearing, and it's an incredible partnership with directly impacted individuals who have been most impacted by the justice system, as well as business and conservatives and progressives and law enforcement and a whole range of folks who really don't agree on much else, which has made it something of a really kind of a cool adventure.
Well, I hope you and yours have a healthy quarantine and are able to get through this without the type of inconvenience that we've been talking about. So many millions of Americans are suffering on a day-to-day basis, irrespective of whether or not there's a global pandemic. I appreciate the work you're doing. She's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, Rebecca Vallis. Rebecca, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks so much, Alex, and you be safe and stay healthy as well.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by The English Beat and Nina Simone.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.